I will now call the third case on today's oral argument calendar. That case is number A24-0580, State of Minnesota versus Walter Hermel Mendez Cabrera. As counsel know, each of you will have 15 minutes for your principal argument, and appellant will have an allotment of 5 minutes for rebuttal argument. The lectern in the courtroom is adjustable by height. You don't have to argue at exactly where it is. There's two buttons on the front ledge that either will make it go up or down, so feel free to adjust it at the beginning of your argument. With that, counsel for appellant, you may identify yourself and your client, and then you may begin.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, opposing counsel, my name is Robert Ambrose, along with attorney Benjamin Cole. We represent the appellant, Mr. Mendez Cabrera. It is not a crime for a drunk person to be a passenger in a motor vehicle. There are limits to physical control in DWI cases. Respondent is asking this court to go beyond those limits. Physical control should not extend to sleeping passengers. The intention of the law is to not punish passengers. Mere presence in or about the vehicle is not enough.
I'll let you finish your introduction and then I have a question. Thank you.
No problem, Your Honor. There needs to be some proof that someone is about to take some action to make the vehicle a source of danger.
I guess my question has to do with the word passenger. I'm wondering whether, as used in the case law, does that mean somebody sitting in the passenger seat, or does it mean when the driver's seat is empty, or does it only mean a person who is in a vehicle which has a driver in the driver's seat?
There is a little bit of a distinction in the Shane case about the known passenger status standard. And in that case, the police did stop a vehicle with a driver, pulled the driver out. The passenger in the front passenger seat put his foot over, started hitting the pedals. That person eventually was arrested for DWI challenge. It was a probable cause challenge in that case, was what the officer knew at that time. Now, in this case, there really wasn't a dispute about whether Mr. Mendez Cabrera was a passenger in the motor vehicle.
I'm not sure I understand that argument, given the fact that even assuming the jury believed Mr. Robles, which they probably didn't based on their verdict, but just assuming for purposes of this question that we have the evidence that we will credit that Mr. Robles picked your client up at 4:20 in the morning and drove the truck till it went off the road at 5:20, but then left by 7. When the police arrived, there's no indication, and in fact, there is no driver on scene for at least an hour and a half, right?
Correct.
So doesn't that, I don't understand why we would look to the Shane more limited test for physical control when we don't have a situation where an officer has taken a driver out and you actually know, in fact, that somebody was a passenger. Why does Shane apply here?
I think Shane is important for a couple of reasons. One, it deals with somebody who actually takes action more than what Mr. Mendez Cabrera did, and they didn't find physical control. Shane actually manipulated the controls and put his foot over to touch the pedals. Here, there's no evidence that Mr. Mendez Cabrera did any of those things. Additionally, I think...
Right, but again, there wasn't a driver who had been removed from this vehicle or anything like that. The rationale behind Shane is the notion that the police knew that this person had not been driving and was not putting the public or themselves at risk by driving. And so there's a little different calculus. There has to be more of a showing of physical control than just the ability to make a car operable, which, the much broader Starfield analysis.
And I believe Shane is what the officer knew at the time, because that was a probable cause to arrest challenge. Here, we're not talking about what the officer knew at the time. We're talking about sufficiency of evidence at trial. And I think one of the most important things to understand in this case is that it was argued and presented to the jury as a physical control case.
There's also evidence of driving. Didn't your client admit to the officer that I drove this truck here?
I think in that part, it's cherry-picked. The least coherent part of the conversation between Mr. Mendez and Cabrera and the officer was that at the very beginning of the encounter in Exhibit 2A, the body-worn camera video, the prosecution cherry-picked that incoherent part of the conversation. There are at least five times before Mr. Mendez Cabrera is arrested on that body-worn camera, up to 6 minutes in, which was played for the jury, where he says, "I'm not the driver here. I'm not driving." That is important to understand, that for three reasons.
And that was evidence the jury heard, and it was for the jury to weigh the credibility of his conflicting statements, right?
Correct, but three things to understand. One, English was not Mr. Mendez Cabrera's first language. He needed an interpreter back at the police department for the breath test advisory. He also needed an interpreter during trial. Two, he just woke up. Three, he was intoxicated. This wasn't a very coherent conversation at the beginning where there may be some admission to him driving, which is very hard to understand. But a point I want to go back to is that this case was argued and presented to the jury as a physical control case, not a driving case.
But was the jury instructed as to the full breadth of the statute in terms of a DWI, which is operation, driving, or physical control? Were they instructed on all of those aspects?
The jury instruction did say DWI is driving, operating, or in physical control. But the court expanded on physical control. There wasn't evidence presented that he drove it there. Respondent at trial overwhelmingly focused on physical control, from opening statement to closing arguments to their brief to this court. In opening statement to the jury, and I quote, "Mr. Mendez Cabrera was intoxicated and was in physical control of a motor vehicle," prosecution statement. Closing arguments to the jury, I quote, "Now, the question here is, was he in physical control of that motor vehicle? The fact that a defendant doesn't have to initially drive the vehicle to this location is not important here." I quote to the jury in closing argument, "What's important is what you heard yesterday. The evidence that's been presented, sleeping in your vehicle while it's running, while you have the keys, while you're the only one there, puts you in physical control of that motor vehicle." In the brief to this court, quote, "Jury could find beyond a reasonable doubt that appellant was in physical control of his vehicle, even if the jury believed Robles had been the original driver that evening." They go on in their brief. Physical control is primarily about forward-looking, and the public policy is that we don't want people to be able to make a vehicle a source of danger with little effort. Even though intent is not an element in the statute on physical control or jury instructions, the whole reason behind physical control is that somebody could just wake up and start operating a motor vehicle.
And couldn't your client have done that? It was running, the lights were on, he had the key, he's in the front seat.
Not with little effort. Overwhelmingly, the cases...
Isn't there cases where someone's outside of the vehicle and they find physical control present because they could just jump back into the car and go?
They certainly are, and there's also evidence that maybe that person drove the vehicle to where it came to rest. Here, I think there are two more important reasons why it wouldn't be easy for Mr. Mendez Cabrera to make this vehicle a source of danger. First, he was asleep. I understand that's not determinative here, and respondent will cite many cases where somebody was sleeping in the driver's seat, but I think sleeping as a passenger is important to understand. Second, and more importantly, he would need to either A, exit the vehicle from the passenger side and walk around and get into the driver's seat, or B, he would have to crawl over the partition-like console in this truck. This truck had a center console that ran along the floorboard all the way up to the dash. He couldn't easily put his foot over and move the vehicle from that position. He couldn't move that vehicle without too much difficulty.
I mean, maybe not in a, you know, in a quick moment or in a matter of seconds, but given an abundance of time, he could have crawled over from one seat to another. It's not that difficult, it seems to me. I mean, if he wants to, I mean, if he wishes to drive the truck somewhere else, he could have done that either in the way you described or that way, or by getting out and going to the other side, right?
And I think the risk is, we're going beyond the limit of physical control. Yes, there's language in cases about physical control should be given the broadest possible effect, but there's still a limit. What if it's a 12-year-old kid in the passenger seat? Well, yeah, they'd have to be under the influence, but it's not that crazy of a notion. What if that person was sleeping in the front passenger seat? Are we going to say they're in physical control? Absolutely not.
It's a jury issue, right? And juries, I mean, it's a multi-factor analysis, right? Doesn't it turn on the particular circumstances?
It certainly does.
And I think you've told us that it's being asleep in a passenger seat that I think your argument says makes the evidence insufficient to support a finding of physical control.
Correct, because I think it would take more than a little effort for a sleeping passenger to make that vehicle a source of danger. I mean, a hypothetical here is, instead of Mr. Robles driving the vehicle, it was Mr. Mendez Cabrera's pregnant wife as a designated driver. Now, regardless of what you think about pregnant women driving their drunk husbands around, but let's say that happened. She started to have complications while she's driving. She pulls over by a gas station and a McDonald's. She runs into the McDonald's. Her husband's passed out in the passenger seat. She's in the bathroom. She's calling her friends. She's calling doctors. What do I do? What do I do? Swearing up and down that her husband is passed out in the driver's seat. She comes out an hour and a half later. Her husband's not there. He's been arrested for DWI. The whole time, he was a sleeping passenger in the vehicle. That is going beyond. This is a slippery slope. If we say a sleeping passenger can be in physical control of a motor vehicle, that is not what this court should be doing. And that's exactly what a respondent is asking the court to do.
Going back to the statement that you said was cherry-picked, was that tested on cross-examination? Did you or defense counsel question the officer about that statement in a way? In other words, you argue in your brief, I think, that statement is not reliable for various reasons. I'm wondering if those reasons were fleshed out in front of the jury.
I don't know for certain on cross-examination of the arresting officer, but I know in the transcript and closing argument from defense counsel, it is brought up that English is not his first language and that he says he's not the driver here. That I'm almost certain is in the transcript. Now, one thing respondent brings up in their brief is that the fact that Mr. Mendez Cabrera could get out of his vehicle and basically start performing or being asked to perform field sobriety tests was proof enough that he had the ability to get in the driver's seat to start driving. And again, I think that goes beyond what physical control is about. I think it's too broad to say somebody has the ability to walk. Well, that person has the physical capability to actually get in the driver's seat and start driving. In Starfield, they say a passenger, by definition, is someone who is merely along for the ride. I think this case goes beyond the limits of physical control. Mere presence in the vehicle as a passenger is not enough. We should not be punishing passengers because there's insufficient evidence in this case to sustain Mr. Mendez Cabrera's convictions for a DWI. We ask this court to reverse his convictions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ambrose. You will have an opportunity for rebuttal. Counsel for respondent, you may approach. Before beginning, please introduce yourself and your client.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Sammy Corlew. I represent the respondent, State of Minnesota, in this case. The defendant here is asking the court to classify himself as a known passenger as a matter of law, but the facts here just do not fit that conclusion. Shane doesn't apply as well as the other case cited, Shane, Lou versus Commissioner. The focus on those cases is the classification as a known passenger. And I make that distinction. Known means generally acknowledged. the court has specifically not just called them passengers, but called them known passengers. What's important in those two cases is that in the facts situation in those two cases, law enforcement stopped that vehicle. The person was seen in the passenger seat of that motor vehicle by someone other than themselves, and the driver was arrested. And so we generally would accept that that person seated there with someone else driving being stopped by law enforcement is a known passenger. We accept that. In this case, that's just not the facts. One factor also noted by the court in Shane is that he was not found alone in the vehicle. And I think that makes an important point here. He was not found alone in the vehicle. This case here, the facts on these are more analogous to Starfield, to Fleck, to Dufresne, than to these known passenger cases.
What's your most opposite authority for that would support a determination that someone who's asleep in the passenger seat, setting aside the Shane case law, assume for the purposes of the question that I agree with you that this is not a known passenger situation, but yet it is someone sleeping in the passenger seat, not the driver's seat. What's the most opposite case that would say that those circumstances would support a determination that this person was in physical control of the motor vehicle?
The hard part that I was able to find to answer that question is I could not find an analysis of someone being found specifically in the passenger seat. And so a lot of the other cases just simply have to do with the location where they're found. And so I want to say, if I pronounce it correctly, Padzerski, Falcon Heights versus Padzerski is probably the one case where in that situation he was found asleep in his vehicle. It was in the driveway of his own house. And so in that case, while he was intoxicated, the court found that he wasn't in physical control under the circumstances, very factual analysis. You know, he was in his car, he was avoiding a domestic situation. And so in that type of situation here, while we don't have that testimony that someone else had driven the vehicle to that location in Padzerski, but that under those circumstances he had gotten home. And so I would say that would be the most apposite case here, because there just simply hasn't been that analysis specifically referencing someone in the passenger seat of a motor vehicle. There's plenty of cases that I cited and as referenced by counsel where someone wasn't even in the vehicle and they were still found in physical control. Going back to talking about Starfield, I think is really important in the discussion that the court had in Starfield. The underlying challenge in that case had to do with the operability of the vehicle, what's important is that vehicle was stuck in a snow-filled ditch, similar to here. Our vehicle was stuck in, or presumably stuck, it was stopped in a grassy ditch-like area. But she had later claimed that someone else had driven the vehicle. We do have some factual differences. She was in the driver's seat of the vehicle, but her vehicle wasn't running. This defendant's vehicle was running. She later claimed her son drove the car to where it stopped. Our case as well. Someone later claimed that they had driven the vehicle to where it stopped. And while, again, the conversation was the operability of the vehicle there, it still upheld the jury's conclusion that she was in physical control of the motor vehicle that day.
Do you take a position as to whether the record, the evidence here would be sufficient for a jury to determine that the state proved beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant had operated or driven this truck?
I think that there is sufficient evidence for the jury to make that determination, and I would focus on, again, the facts, the other factors that come into play here. The vehicle was running. He had the keys in his pocket. He was alone in the vehicle, and there was no other evidence that anyone else had placed that vehicle or had gotten that vehicle to that scene. The officer did testify that had he received information that someone else had driven the vehicle to its location, he would have changed his investigation. It would have altered the way that he operated his investigation. So I do believe that the jury had enough evidence to convict on driving as well.
What about the appellant's own statement, which I think came in through the officer, right?
That he had been driving? Yeah, I think that supports that as well, that utterance right off the bat that he had driven the vehicle. Now, counsel wants to say, you know, he said, I wasn't driving. No, technically you weren't stopped by law enforcement driving. I can see how that type of statement could be made at that point by him, but that was a point made at argument that he admitted to driving the vehicle right on the front end, and the jury was able to hear that on the body camera footage that he admitted to that as well.
Oh, that came in through the video and audio tape, not testimony, or both?
Both.
Okay,
yep.
Thank you.
Yep. Fleck is also interesting and kind of supported here for the evidence here, because Fleck, again, he was asleep in his vehicle, albeit in the driver's seat in that car, but he was in the parking lot of an apartment complex, and there's at least a comment that he lived at the apartment complex. And in that case, the court concluded that the jury could reasonably find that Fleck, being alone, intoxicated, sleeping behind the wheel of his own vehicle with the keys in the center console, was in a position to exercise dominion and control over his vehicle, and could, without too much difficulty, make the vehicle a source of danger. The too much difficulty was also raised. Now, there was a discussion about him getting out of the car and going to the driver's seat, and I would submit to this court that seems like a much less difficult situation than the other situations the court's been faced with in terms of a flat tire. Changing a flat tire, a dead battery needing to be jump-started, a vehicle being towed from the ditch. The courts classified those things as temporary disabilities for the operability of a motor vehicle, and yet the folks that were found in situations such as that were found in physical control of their motor vehicles despite those disabilities. Sleeping in a motor vehicle when you're intoxicated is a temporary disability, and the video evidence presented to the jury showed that from the officer's body camera footage that when he knocked on the driver's side door, the defendant awoke relatively easily. It took a couple knocks, but he was able to wake, you know, at 6 a.m. Easily.
I thought he didn't awake until the door was opened.
He knocked and, yes, opened the door, and then he awoke. But they believe there was one to two knocks on the door before he opened the door. If I remember the testimony, the vehicle was a bigger truck, and the officer himself couldn't see into the truck to see somebody right away either, and had opened the door then. But I'd say it's relatively not much difficulty to wake him, or for an individual to wake up in general. I don't think the court needs to establish someone else needs to wake you up to dispel that difficulty standard. The court pointed out in Starfield, you know, alcoholic behavior can be unpredictable. A person may get or be put in a car to sleep it off and then decide to drive away. I think that's important here. Nothing was preventing this individual from waking up, getting into the driver's seat, and driving that vehicle away. Even being stuck in a ditch, had that vehicle not moved, prior case law says you're still in physical control of that motor vehicle. Pointing out as well, so Woodward is another case similar here where there's a dispute or lack of evidence, if I should say, as to how the vehicle got to its location. I disagree with counsel. I think there was some dispute about how the vehicle got to the location where it was stopped. No other driver on the scene. And in Woodward as well, another, you know, testimony that someone else had driven the vehicle, still upholding that physical control in Woodward. And Woodward was, if I recall correctly, outside of the vehicle when law enforcement had arrived. She was on the roadway, had a flat tire. So again, under those circumstances, there was a finding of physical control. you know, going back to some of the underlying policies, as kind of briefly mentioned, you know, we want to avoid situations where inebriated persons are found in parked cars, again, without difficulty of moving it. Council brought up a, you know, pregnant woman driving to a scene. I think that is exactly what the officer was testifying to, that had that information been presented right off the bat, that woman was inside, the investigation would turn something different. But I would argue that that person, albeit asleep in the motor vehicle, still under physical control, can easily access or exercise dominion over the motor vehicle. Now, in that situation, switch the facts a little bit. Maybe it's not a push-button vehicle, and she takes the keys with her and goes into the bathroom. Then I would say, no, there's probably not physical control there, because there's no way to move that vehicle at that point under that circumstance. But that's just not what we have here. Council.
Significance to the fact that the engine was running?
I think that's highly significant here. And it's important because then it also relates to how easily that vehicle could have been moved. But there are plenty of cases that have been decided where the vehicle was not running. And so that's an important fact that the jury was able to consider, along with the fact that he was the owner of the vehicle. He had the keys in his possession. But I think that that's helpful to the jury to see that that vehicle could have been moved. Council wants the court to require that some proof of action be taken, that they're actively making steps towards moving that vehicle. And that's just simply not what this court has done in the past. As I've mentioned, there's plenty of case decisions that of individuals asleep, slumped over the vehicle. The differentiation here is the location of the individual in the car. They've been found in the driver's seat of the car. And so while I still believe that being in a passenger side of the car, no different than being in the back seat of a car, puts you in physical control of that motor vehicle. If, you know, the recent case, I don't have the site decision by, oh, I do, excuse me, State versus Nelson, a recent decision by the court of August of this year, a defendant was found unconscious in the back seat of his vehicle after he had inhaled fumes. Keys were in the rear passenger wheel well, but the car wasn't running. And the court found that the record shows that he was inside the vehicle. He could access the controls, and he knew where the keys were located. And that's important as well, to finding that this individual was not a known passenger, that he just truly simply was in physical control of that motor vehicle. And, Your Honor, you pointed out that time difference, and that was an argument that was made to the jury as well, the time difference, the testimony. So even if you believe Mr. Robles for a moment that he truly was the sober driver, and under those circumstances, unlike Padzerski, he didn't leave the defendant in his driveway asleep in his motor vehicle. He left him stuck in the snowbank at a gas station and left him there for over an hour and a half. And that changes. But I would also submit that another case recently found someone in physical control for mere minutes when he did make active steps to get into the car to try and get into the driver's seat, but he was originally driven to his location by someone else as well. They got into a fight, and I apologize, I don't have the case site on that one. But mere minutes, he was in the driver's seat in physical control. We're talking about, you know, the testimony, if you believe Mr. Robles, was over an hour and a half by himself.
At trial, did the state challenge the truthfulness of Robles' testimony?
There was some questioning about his, you know, his testimony on it, but I wouldn't say that there was in-depth questioning to try and, there were some questions to try and nail down the timing of when things, but that was, I think, the extent of it. Yeah. And with that, that's my time. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Corlew. Oh, excuse me, Ms. Corlew, thank you for your argument. Counsel for appellant, you have an opportunity for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Location of an ignition key is not determinative. It is yet just one factor to consider under the totality of the circumstances. Under the totality of the circumstances here, Mr. Mendez-Cabrera was not in physical control of the motor vehicle. I think we really need to remember the intention of physical control is to not punish passengers. Here, Mr. Mendez-Cabrera was an intoxicated passenger in the motor vehicle. And we're talking about sufficiency of evidence at trial, not probable cause to arrest like in Shane. Another thing in this case is during the interaction with the officer, when Mr. Mendez-Cabrera is outside of the truck, the officer is just jumping to conclusions and just saying it doesn't matter if you're the driver or not. The five times Mr. Mendez-Cabrera is saying something to the effect, I'm not driving, I'm not the driver, the officer responds with remarks like, it doesn't matter. And that's also what was argued to the jury. They're basically saying it doesn't matter if he drove it there or not. They're just saying his status is a sleeping passenger, which is why I think this court should say he was a passenger, because that was the argument and the evidence presented to the jury, was that he was a passenger.
Well, he was found in the passenger seat. I mean, that was the evidence, right?
Well, the testimony from Mr. Robles was that he was the front seat passenger, and you drove him there.
And so your argument is once you've been a passenger, you can never be found to be in physical control of a motor vehicle? That seems to me to be a broad brush, but
I think it's too broad to say that somebody's sitting in the front passenger seat of a truck with a console that runs from the floorboard to the dash that you can't just slide over into the driver's seat is somehow in physical control of a motor vehicle. How are they physically controlling that vehicle? With their mind?
Well, they have to be able to, without much difficulty, make it operable. Isn't that the test? Not that they're necessarily doing it at the time.
Correct. And I think the two points are, one, he has to wake up. He has to exit the vehicle too and get out and go to the driver's side or climb completely over this console and get into the driver's seat. Three of the cases respondent just cited in her argument, Starfield, Fleck, and Dufresne, all include somebody in the driver's seat. That is the overwhelming majority of physical control cases cited by this court, is when somebody is asleep in the driver's seat or awake in the driver's seat. Here, we have a passenger, not somebody in the driver's seat. I think that is one of the most important, if not the most important, fact in this case. He's a sleeping passenger, and the intent of the law was never to say, well, you know, if that person is asleep in the vehicle, but we can't find anybody else, they are physically controlling that vehicle. I know at some point we may have to deal with an autonomous driving fact scenario, but we don't have that here. Yes, he has a key fob in his pocket. It's not uncommon for many people to be a passenger and have the key fob in their pocket or a fanny pack or a purse while another person is driving. That is not uncommon at all. It is a factor under the totality of the circumstances that, yes, the vehicle was on. Yes, he owned the truck. Yes, he had the key fob in his pocket. But we have to look at the fact that he was a passenger in this motor vehicle, and that he was asleep. And the standard is, without too much difficulty, could he make that vehicle a source of danger? I think it would take beyond little effort. It would be difficult for him to wake up, move, walk around the truck, or completely climb over, and then, okay, now I'm gonna start driving. For those reasons, I do not believe there is sufficient evidence to convict Mr. Robles of being in physical control. We ask the court to reverse his convictions. No further questions? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ambrose. Thank you to both attorneys for your argument. The case is submitted. The court will issue its opinion in writing within 90 days.